Some years ago, a rather shocking survey was taken among young athletes in the United States. And they were asked whether or not they would take a banned substance if it would guarantee them a medal at a World Championships or an Olympic Games. And the shock was that so many of them said they would be prepared to do that. Well, if you've been following the sort of the sports news, you'll know that last week one of those chickens came home to roost. But let's not be naive about what's going on. Here are the six men in history who have run under 9.8 seconds for the 100 metres. How many of them have been proven to be drug cheats? 1 to 6 is not very difficult. It is 5. Only one is not a drug cheat. Therefore, the logic of the choice those young athletes said they would make is obvious, isn't it? If I'm going to be as good as they are, as fast as they are, I better be taking what they're taking. And this was the chicken that came home to roost this week. Nesta Carter, you wouldn't have recognised him, apart from maybe one or two very geeky ones among you. You would have no idea who he is. He was one of those who decided that he needed to add something to his training, to his diet, his conditioning, and his natural talent. Just add a little substance. Then I can be what I want to be. Then I can achieve what I want to achieve. That's the way into the record books. That's the way to get gold. But when the frozen samples taken at the Beijing Games were retested, he was found to have taken a banned substance. He'd lost everything. He'd lost his good reputation. He was no longer a clean athlete. And of course, he lost his gold medal from the 100 metres relay at Beijing. But of course, it wasn't just him who paid the price for that, was it? You'll probably recognise the guy on the right. One of the greatest athletes the world has ever seen, who achieved 3 gold medals at 3 successive Olympic Games in the 100 metres, the 200 metres and the sprint relay. The treble-treble, as it's been called. But of course, he no longer holds the treble-treble because he has lost one of those gold medals. What Nesta Carter did didn't just cost himself, but it also cost his teammates and maybe cost one of the greatest athletes of all time, one of the greatest Olympic achievements of all time. Simply because he chose to add something, to add that banned substance to his natural talent, to his hard work, his training, his diet, and his conditioning. And that additive destroyed everything in time. In the book of Galatians, it is what the false teachers are adding to Paul's gospel that will destroy all the benefits of that gospel in time. Paul's gospel says Jesus is sufficient. Jesus is everything. You need no more than him. The other gospel says, the additive says, to be sure of your membership, to be sure you're getting to heaven, then just add a bit. Let's add a bit of law. Let's add a bit of circumcision. It's only a small thing and it'll make all the difference. And of course, yes, it will make all the difference in time. Because in time, you will lose everything. All the benefits of Jesus' gospel will be lost. And of course, if you're in a leadership position and you're teaching such additions, then you will encourage others to lose everything as well. And believe me, what we will lose through this false gospel is of far greater significance than an Olympic gold medal, than even a treble-treble. So remember, in the Christian faith, in the Christian gospel, Jesus plus equals Jesus minus. Jesus plus anything equals nothing. Jesus plus nothing equals everything. And so this disagreement between Peter and Paul, which you looked at in detail last week, really does matter. The issue at stake is critical. Because of what Peter did, because of what the false teachers are teaching, the truth of the gospel is under threat. Twice in chapter 2, Paul talks about the truth of the gospel. And it's to that truth which Paul now comes in these few verses at the end of chapter 2. And it may well be that this is what Paul said in the meeting with Peter and the others in Antioch. And it's certainly what the rest of the letter is built on. So, first of all then, we're put right with God only through faith in Jesus. How can I be right with God? I think Ellie gave us a brilliant description of what most people would answer to that question. Being reasonable, not being too unkind, trying to live a good enough sort of life, just trying to be a nice, respectable, middle-class Tunbridge Wellian. That will do. Surely that must be good enough, won't it? Well, in many ways, that is what Peter and Paul had been brought up thinking through Judaism. But look what Paul says in verse 15. We ourselves, Peter and John, Peter and Paul, we ourselves are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners. Yet we know that a person is not justified by works of the law. Peter and Paul had tried it. Paul was a scholar within it. Who better to tell us that it can't work to make you right with God? You cannot be justified by works of the law. Two definitions there that are going to be very important as we go through this letter. What does it mean to be justified? It means to be declared righteous. It means to be in right standing with God. And the little sort of helpful way of thinking about it, God treats me just as if I'd never sinned. Works of the law? Well, all that is demanded in the law, the rites and the rituals as well as the rules. Right standing with God then doesn't come through works of the law, it comes only through Jesus. Doesn't matter how religious, doesn't matter what religion, they can't help. Not even Judaism, the best of religions, the prince of religions, because its job was to point people to Jesus, to deliver the promise about him. We'll pick that up as we go on in the book a bit later. Just have a look a bit more closely at verse 16. Three times in verse 16, Paul gives us the negative. Not justified by works of the law. By works of the law, no one will be justified. Not by works of the law. Three very strong negatives that Paul gives us in that verse. And three times we're encouraged to believe in Jesus. But through faith in Jesus, we've also believed in Jesus in order to be justified by faith in Christ. Three times, not the law, not works of the law, three times, but Jesus. And yet it's remarkable just how strong the grip of this religious rites, rituals, rule keeping is upon us. You may have come across the phrase, outside the church there is no salvation. And to a certain extent we'd want to say yes to that if it means because the church has the responsibility of telling the gospel of good news of Jesus to other people. That's fine. But no, if it means you get to God by the rules, the rites, the rituals of a particular church. But of course that phrase, outside the church there's no salvation, is from the Roman Catholic Church. And what they mean by it is, there's no salvation outside of their baptism, their rules about confession, and the Mass. all of which must be administered by a validly ordained priest, as they would call them. And just so as you're not confused, neither Giles nor Carrie nor I are recognized as valid ordained ministers by the Roman Catholic Church. We're not part of that particular group. And the Roman Catholic Catechism says they could not be saved who, knowing that the Catholic Church was founded as necessary by God through Christ, would refuse either to enter into it or to remain in it. Now we see what we mean by there's no salvation outside the church, don't we? We have chosen not to be members of the Roman Catholic Church. Therefore, we cannot be saved. That's what that is saying. We've done that consciously, and we choose to meet here rather than elsewhere in town. And we need reminding of this because this is the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. And as you'll probably have heard, various people are trying to say that the Reformation was a mistake and it was a bad thing and all the rest of it. The Reformation was a brilliant thing. It freed us from the grip of religion, or so it should have done. But of course, we have this default that wants to think it's about me and my effort and what I do. And so we keep going back to it. Because Roman Catholicism stands for all religion, all cults, because they all behave the same way. They all say it's about our way, it's about our understanding, it's through our leadership. But the gospel says no. Jesus plus nothing equals everything. We're put right with God only through faith in Jesus. Secondly, verses 17 and 18. Don't go back to something that cannot make us right with God. You see, the law is powerless to save us from sin. The law says all are sinners, for none keep the law. And our status and the status of everyone in the world is summed up by Psalm 143 and verse 2. No one is righteous before you. The you there is the Lord Almighty. So verse 17. But if in our endeavor to be justified in Christ, we too were found to be sinners, is Christ then a servant of sin? You see, because the gospel, the good news, tells us that we're sinners, the accusation seems to be, well, therefore, Jesus has made you a sinner. Therefore, he sort of serves sin by making you a sinner. Well, think of it like this. When you go and see your GP, when you go to the doctor, and the doctor gives you your diagnosis and tells you what to do about your condition, has the doctor made you ill? Well, of course the doctor hasn't made you ill. He's just told you what's wrong with you and told you what you can do about it. So it is with Jesus. He doesn't make us sinners. The gospel, he shows us we are sinners and shows us what we need to do about it as well. Rather, Paul goes on to say, verse 18, if I rebuild what I tore down, I prove myself to be a transgressor. Another word for a sinner. We prove our sinfulness because we go back to the law. And all that does is tell us we're sinful. And we try and put in place something that is out of date and gone. But to be put right with God, you've got to begin by recognizing I am a sinner. I am in rebellion against God. The word found in verse 17 is a sort of a legal term. It's about standing before a judge. It's about knowing yourself to be guilty before him. That's where we have to start. But of course, we also continue in that same way. You'll have, if you've been a Christian any length of time, you will know. You become increasingly aware of your sin. You become increasingly aware of your poverty before God and that you have so little to offer. And it's strange, isn't it, that that sort of daily reminder goes hand in hand with a daily temptation to think we can be good enough. To think, yes, of course I was worth saving. God did a jolly good thing there, made a very wise choice. To think, yes, of course I'm paying God back. It's a bit like a mortgage. I'll get there in the end. I want to earn it myself. I want to do it by my own efforts. The grace of God has torn down that human effort-making goal. It cannot help us. Its day is over. It's redundant. It may be that Einstein said something like this, or it may not. We don't really know, but it'll help us regardless. Doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting different results, is a definition of madness. Why go back to the things you know have failed? Why go back to the law when you know it only makes you sinful and can't deal with sin? Why go back to things that will only destroy your great hope of being right with God? Why add the banned substance to your training regime to break the records? Jesus plus anything equals nothing. So don't go back to something that cannot make us right with God. Thirdly, then, verses 19 to 21. We receive the gift of life only through the death of Christ. And Paul encourages us not to reject the grace of God by seeking life through the law. Look what grace has done for us. We've been declared not guilty in verses 16 and 21. Justified through faith in Christ. Justification through Christ's death. 19 and 20, we've been given new life. Right? For through the law I died to the law, I might live to God. I've been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life I live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God. This is the free gift of God. This is all by his generosity. All because Jesus died. The grace of God is so big and so marvelous. He puts everything else in its shade. Nothing else can come close when we look at the grace of God. So it's just an amazing thing, isn't it? Why should anybody want to add anything to Jesus' death? It's a complete mystery. Jesus was born under the law, we learn in chapter 4. And Jesus died to redeem those of us who were under the law. He paid the penalty for us who were cursed by the law. And because Jesus died according to the law and under the law, we too have died to that law. We've died to the law through the body of Jesus. That law is dead to us. It's an era that has passed. Its day has come and gone. And we now live in the era of salvation and the era of life. And we have that guaranteed to us by the Spirit who lives within us. Verse 20. I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. What is the consequence of that? Christ lives in me by his Spirit. And the life I live by faith in him. So we keep Jesus central. And we keep Jesus' death at the very heart of our faith and our confidence and our trust. I won't return to that previous time when I thought it was about me and my efforts. Ellie would think that was a ridiculous thing to do, as she said to us tonight. I won't listen to the voices that tell me I need to do a bit more. I just need to add some of my own effort to make sure. Well, if the results are so brilliant and the remedy so straightforward, why on earth do so many people fall for the false teaching? Well, let's just go back to those athletes we were thinking about at the start. It may be that as individuals they are prepared to win at all costs. But it's much more likely that it's about being part of the team, part of the group. I don't want to let the team down. The taking of banned substances within sort of the Western world has very much been to do with particular training groups and particular teams. And so I want to belong. My identity is bound up with my membership of the group. And maybe that's even more important than my success as an individual or even the success of the group. And so to deny or to damage or to threaten what's going on is actually to deny, to damage or to threaten my sense of belonging. I came across this in the magazine from my paper last Sunday. We all need to feel understood, recognized and affirmed by our friends, family and romantic partners. We all need to find our tribe. Research has shown that among the benefits that come with being in a relationship or group, a sense of belonging clocks in as the most important driver of meaning. When other people think you matter and treat you as if you matter, you believe you matter too. The false teachers say, come and be part of our group. You can be sure by just doing this. Let us baptize you. Stop eating meat on Fridays. It's not much, is it? Just a little extra, but it'll help you to be part of this group and just help you to be sure about your belonging and your future. That's just the sort of little extra that will destroy what you most want, to be right with God and to be a member of his people. Because we receive this gift of life and membership only through the death of Jesus. Jesus plus equals Jesus minus. Jesus plus anything equals nothing. Jesus plus nothing equals everything.